From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up in the show, there's a wind farm being built in Rio Vista. How practical a source of energy is wind? Also, local Olympic gold medalist Gabe Gardner of U.S. men's volleyball. And Sacramento singers Kate Gaffney and Sal Valentino, they're in concert together tonight and will play live in our studio this afternoon. But first, the Republican National Convention. As you might recall, this time last week, we caught up with Sacramento photojournalist Max Whitaker, who was in Denver covering the Democratic convention. Now he's in St. Paul covering the Republicans. Max, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
I hear you're in a place of public radio interest right now.
Yes, I'm at Mickey's Diner, which is, I think, in the concluding scene of the movie version of Prairie Home Companion.
That's right. Now, I hear that you got a little roughed up earlier this week. What happened?
I did on Monday. Monday was the first day of the convention here, and it was also the first day of significant protests. And I was pepper sprayed briefly. So along with a number of other photographers, fortunately, I received just a glancing blow, but it was unpleasant to say the least.
Why did you get that in your face? What happened?
I was covering a group of protesters that had split off the permitted the police. Had tried to prevent them from proceeding any further down a street, and the protesters kept going, so the police broke out their pepper spray, and I happened to be in the middle.
And tell us, what's it like getting pepper spray in your face?
Yeah, fortunately, I didn't receive a direct hit in the eyes, which is usually what they go for, but it's very spicy, let's say. It's a burning sensation that actually lasts quite a while. The day before yesterday, on Tuesday, I was also tear gassed, which is a little bit more intense, but doesn't last as long.
And then there was something else happened, too, another altercation.
Yeah, well, I think that was the event on Tuesday, which happened outside. That was Wednesday. They're all running together for me now. And that was the one at Mickey's Diner where a protest was kind of winding down. And the cops hemmed a bunch of the protesters actually just headed back to their cars. They hemmed us in with a bunch of the press in with the protesters, and we got tear gassed. So it was fairly unpleasant.
I'm talking with Sacramento photojournalist Max Whitaker. Last week he was in Denver covering the Democratic convention. This week he's in St. Paul covering the Republican convention. And you've been assigned to cover protests at both conventions. Any difference that you've noticed in the policing and in the protesters?
Yeah, there's been significant differences on both fronts. In Denver, the protesters were almost all peaceful. The protests went off without a hitch. And the police went out with fairly extreme show of force. There was, you couldn't walk down any street in downtown Denver without seeing a police officer in riot gear. Here in the Twin Cities, there's less of a show of force, but they seem to be trying to intimidate the protest groups a little bit more, especially in advance by raiding different homes and headquarters of different groups in advance. And then during the protests here, they mobilize fairly rapidly as soon as they think it's going to go violent. And that's another huge difference here. The protests about the same size as Denver, but they seem to be more readily infiltrated by groups of anarchists whose main mission is to create property destruction, it seems like.
Did you see those same groups of anarchists or people like them in Denver, or did they just have more luck, so to speak, in St. Paul?
I didn't really see them in Denver.
Yeah.
So I think it's because it's the Republican convention as opposed to the Democrats. I mean, I think almost all protests are liberal or anti-war, and I think here is where they feel they really need to deliver their message.
I've been checking out some of the photographs that you've taken in St. Paul, and you were on Celebrity Watch yesterday.
Great.
tell us about some of the people you saw and you photographed.
Yesterday, I photographed Rosario Dawson, an actress who was on the floor of the convention promoting a nonpartisan sort of get-out-the-vote group. also photographed Mo Rocca from the Tonight Show with Jay Leno, and then last night photographed the rock group Rage Against the Machine, who has performed both in Denver and the Twin Cities in advance of each convention.
But there was a problem with their concert in the Twin Cities, wasn't there?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, I think most listeners would probably know a little bit about Rage Against the Machine. Most of their lyrics are fairly anti-authoritarian, anti-establishment. And, you know, the crowd came out and was met by cops in riot gear. So there was, let's say, some minor mayhem. And I saw about half dozen people get arrested. So, but relatively minor compared to earlier in the week in St. Paul.
Now, last week we talked about the impact of the convention on Denver and the people there. What do you see in St. Paul? Do you see the locals out and about much? How do they seem to be reacting to everything that's going on in the city right now?
You know, they seem to be taking it in stride. You know, just like Denver, the folks of St. Paul and Minneapolis are, you know, fairly laid back, extremely nice people. And they seem to be taking it in stride. I mean, I think some of the downtown businesses in St. Paul are a little bit more worried here because there has been property destruction. I mean, there's been windows smashed and cars destroyed. So some businesses have closed during some hours and on some days in order to avoid some of that.
Okay. And so I guess you wrap up today.
Yes. I'm on my way right now to cover a protest is beginning at the state capitol and making its way to Excel. And after covering that for a little bit, I'll head inside and shoot McCain's speech to conclude the convention.
And then home after 2 weeks away.
Exactly. Looking forward to getting back to Sacramento.
Max, thanks so much for joining us again today.
Thank you, Jeff.
Sacramento photojournalist Max Whitaker is in St. Paul covering the Republican National Convention. By the way, Max is married to Insight's senior producer, Jen Picard. This is Insight. The Delta town of Rio Vista will soon be a real powerhouse. A wind farm is being built there. When it's finished, expected at the end of this year, the wind farm turbines will produce 150 megawatts of electricity for PG&E. How efficient an energy source is wind, and what challenges need to be overcome? In our studio is Mark Thalke, who's director of the Southwest Region for the renewable energy company that's building this wind farm called Shiloh 2. The company's called Enexco. Mark, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Why build a wind farm in Rio Vista?
Well, Rio Vista in Solano County is one of the top three, by our analysis, top three wind resource areas in California. And thus we are, it's in the top four. It's third on our priority list. I should say it's in the top three for our priority list, and it's actually our top priority for wind power development. This year, of course, our project is in construction.
And that's because of all the wind blowing in from the bay.
That's right. There's, you know, as you might imagine, wind resource varies due to geographics, geography, and terrain. And Altamont Pass, Tehachapi, Solano County, Palm Springs, these are the top wind resource areas in California.
Give us an idea of how big a deal 150 megawatts is. What can you do with 150 megawatts?
150 megawatts, it's a large project. The wind industry has come a long way, even in the last five, certainly within the last 10 years. 150 megawatts, that's going to power probably, I'd have to do the back of the envelope calculation. 150 megawatts is, in terms of renewable energy and the environmental impact, that's equivalent to over 65,000 cars removed from the road annually.
Okay. Give us some idea of the visual impact of this wind farm. How tall, how expansive over the ground is it?
Well, the wind turbine, the towers themselves, so the machine head of the wind, they're three-bladed machines, tubular tower, the nacelle or the machine head, that's going to be a little less than 70 meters off the ground.
So that's about 200 feet or so.
Yeah. And then the rotor itself is a 92-meter rotor. So, you know, half that, and that's the top of the reach of the structure. There will be 75 individual turbines. This is in an area that already has quite some number of turbines already spinning.
So this is going to be quite visible from a distance because of the height and because of the number of
It will, and again, it's sort of a build out of an existing wind resource area, so it's not going to be anything new to the town of Rio Vista.
How competitive is wind energy? The company you work for, Enexco, is also involved in solar. How does wind compare with solar? How effective is it? How efficient is it, rather?
Yeah, well, Enexco is a wind power development company. We have our roots, over 20 years in the wind industry, and we've recently branched into solar as we see an opportunity in solar. Wind energy is more cost effective than solar.
And why is that?
That is when we levelize the cost of energy and you factor in the capital cost of the equipment and tax credits that are available from the federal government, accelerated depreciation, you roll that up into a financial model, the power rate to the utility for wind energy is lower than the power rate that the utility must pay us for a solar project. And we expect that the trend for solar is going down, and we expect that someday they will cross.
I'm talking with Mark Thalke, director of the Southwest Region for the renewable energy company Enexco, which is building the Shiloh 2 wind farm near Rio Vista. PG&E is going to buy this electricity. Mm-hmm. How does the cost of the electricity generated by this wind farm, how does that compare to older style, more mainstream sources of electricity? Let's say a coal generating plant.
Now, coal is less expensive, bar none. However, that is not including the externalities associated with coal energy, and as well as the subsidies and support that coal energy has enjoyed over the years. So it's a little bit of a tricky question in terms of right now, on the face of it, wind energy is more expensive. But when you factor in the costs associated with climate change, mercury, and other SOx, NOx, et cetera, pollutants.
But those are society-wide expenses and
right.
inconveniences and growing over time. But right now, PG&E has to shell out X amount of dollars for electricity. Does it make financial sense for companies like PG&E today to buy wind, or are they doing it because they have to?
I guess I'm not going to comment on whether they are doing it because they have to or whether they want to do it, but I should emphasize that California has one of the most aggressive renewable portfolio standards in the country. Renewable portfolio standard meaning a mandate that requires purchasing renewable energy. So PG&E is subject to 20% requirement by 2010. 20% of PG&E's electricity must come from renewables.
By the way, we did invite someone from PG&E to take part in this discussion, and someone was booked, but fairly last-minute scheduling conflict occurred, and so there will be no one from PG&E, and that's why I put that PG&E question to our guest, Mark Thalke. We're going to talk about a related issue to the generation of wind power, and that is the impact or possible impact on birds. Sean Smallwood is with us. He's an expert on the Altamont Pass wind resource area. He's a member of the Scientific Review Committee for that organization. Sean Smallwood, welcome to Insight.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here too.
What impact do wind farms have on birds?
Well, they kill birds directly through collision. They also kill bats. And there's an avoidance of some wind farms or some avoidance behavior. Some birds just simply stop using the area. So there's habitat loss.
What have humans, you talked about birds avoiding an area with turbines. What have humans learned from Altamont Pass and other places that is or could be put into place at a project like Shiloh 2 in Rio Vista?
Oh, Altamont Pass has probably been recipient of most of the public sector research on the problem. So National Renewable Energy Lab and California Energy Commission has put quite a bit of money into the Altamont Pass. And those of us who have been working the problem have been trying to find associations between fatalities and turbine location, turbine model or turbine types, attributes, time of year, all these kinds of things. And we've learned that siting is very important. That's one of the most important things. The way the bird behavior interfaces with the turbine height, the winds in the area and the topography are very important. So we can, I think, more carefully site wind turbines to minimize the impacts.
Are birds still being killed at Altamont Pass?
They are, and it's just as many numbers as always. I mean, we have not seen any reduction in mortality whatsoever for the last couple of years.
Because the turbines can't be relocated, I guess.
Well, they can, and there's been some effort to do
or
that.
Haven't
in fact,
been relocated.
Well, yeah. Some have been, actually. And NEXCO has been one of the leaders in relocating wind turbines in the Altamont Pass. But many more need to be relocated to make a big difference. We just aren't getting anywhere near the target that we have of a 50% mortality reduction during this three-year time period that we're in right now. We have one more year left in our program.
From the point of view of birds, is Altamont Pass an appropriate place for a wind farm?
It might be an appropriate place if the wind turbines had a different technology that didn't kill so many of them, or if they were sited more carefully. But right now, it's probably not appropriate, given that the types of turbines that are operating out there and the way they're operating, it's killing way too many birds.
And what is it about Altamont Pass that makes it a less appropriate place from the point of view of birds and people who care about them for a wind farm?
It's a pass, which means it's a low spot in the topography. So the birds are not stupid. They certainly will use topography to their advantage. And when they're flying across a landscape from one place to another, they will take the low pass, the low spot on the environment. So there's a huge collection of birds. There's also a winter aggregation of raptors, red-tailed hawks, golden eagles. Many subadult and juvenile golden eagles come to the Altamont Pass and stay there.
I don't know how familiar you are with the Rio Vista area, but how does that compare with Altamont Pass?
I'm not really sure because I've not been directly involved with the Rio Vista wind farm. And I have gotten some data from one or two reports, and I've looked at the data. My sense is that the mortality is overall lower for at least the High Winds project. I don't know about Shiloh. But I also, I'm concerned about this avoidance effect. I see golden eagles not using the area anymore. There may be some habitat loss going on in Shiloh or Rio Vista.
We're talking about wind farms in general, specifically right now their impact on birds. But more generally here, we're talking about the Shiloh 2 wind farm that's being built in Rio Vista. Mark Thalke at NEXCO, which is building Shiloh 2. Could you address these bird issues that Sean Smallwood has raised?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think most in the industry would agree, and I don't know if that Sean would, I believe he would, that Altamont Pass is an outlier in terms of its impact to birds. Altamont Pass is a bad place to site those older machines. The wind industry is agreeing to make some changes by constructing new machines that are larger in terms of this, so there's going to be fewer number of total machines, tubular towers, slower moving blades. Solano County, I would submit, is materially different. It's a totally different geography in terms of terrain. The siting of our wind turbines are following different procedures than which was followed in the early days of the Altamont Pass before bird mortality was on anybody's radar.
Would the wind power industry put turbines on Altamont Pass today, or would you just put different turbines on Altamont Pass today?
Well, there is an ongoing effort to what we call repower, which basically means knocking down the old, smaller machines, which we consider more dangerous to birds of concern and birds in general, and erecting new, larger turbines. One of the larger turbines is equivalent to 10 or more of the smaller turbines.
Sean Smallwood, any reaction to what Mark Falke's been saying?
Well, I think there's a potential to repowering as long as it's done in a very careful manner. But I'm also concerned about the lack of enforcement of environmental laws in the Altamont Pass and lack of permit compliance. The companies are issued permits from the county of Alameda and Contra Costa and the Altamont Pass, and it's like the permits don't even exist. They just do what they want. And I think that if the repowering is going to take place, there needs to be some safeguards built in, maybe some performance bonds, as well as some mechanisms for enforcement to take place.
Mark Falke, another issue I understand with wind farms is their impact on radar systems, and the Travis Air Force Base is quite close to the Shiloh 2 wind farm in Rio Vista. What do the turbines do that causes a problem with radar?
We did encounter some problem solving with Travis Air Force Base on this. Basically, the spinning blades give a false signal on the radar. So pilots the turbines make it seem like there's basically could be a plane underneath them, which is an issue for them. And we feel that there's a software fix. We've been working very closely with Travis Air Force to address this issue. And
But there isn't long to go. You're looking at finishing the construction at Shiloh 2 quite soon, aren't you?
Yes, and Travis and Anexco worked very closely together. They do not have an objection to Shiloh 2. Remember, Shiloh 2 is right next to a bunch of existing wind turbines. It's not that we are erecting a brand new project in the middle of nowhere.
Yes. By the way, we did also invite Travis Air Force Base to take part in this discussion, but that went nowhere. What happens if there's no wind blowing?
The turbines don't spin, and there's no electricity is generated.
Does that happen much in a place like Rio Vista?
It does. They do not spin all the time. Sometimes they're just they're idle. Most of the time they're spinning, and sometimes they're really spinning, which is represents it really is money blowing in the wind. We are paid directly the way the tax credits are structured. Of course, the way we are paid from PG&E is directly related to the wind speed.
So it's not an entirely reliable source of electricity. I mean, if a utility were to rely solely on wind, how would they get around that?
Yeah, and I think utilities are getting more increasingly sophisticated in dealing with wind, which is an intermittent resource. So is solar energy. Utilities are getting increasingly sophisticated with being able to anticipate weather systems with improved forecasting techniques, as well as being able to integrate the fluctuations in electricity generation into the grid. A country like Denmark is over 20% wind, and they're approaching 30, and it is being integrated without brownouts or blackouts, and it does cause some challenges for the utilities. I should say the vast majority of utilities are taking this challenge head on. They recognize that it's not just AB 32 and a renewable portfolio standard in California. Wind energy is growing, I won't say exponentially, but growing dramatically around the country, especially in the Midwest corridor. Texas has surpassed California as the most wind turbine installed. And people recognize that, you know, we need a solution to, we need an alternative to fossil fuel power.
And finally, Mark, California overall, and I know the Sacramento area as part of it, sees itself as an important part of the green energy sector. But as I understand, the turbine parts that arrived recently in Sacramento were made overseas, Denmark and Korea, and Anexco is itself a subsidiary of the French energy giant EDF. How California is wind energy?
Well, California is what some people consider, and I consider, the birthplace of wind energy. It was early tax credits, which many argue were inefficient, but that is what got the wind industry going. And now, of course, it is a global phenomenon, and it is increasing dramatically. And I think any credible analysis will see that it will continue, as well as solar and other forms of renewable energy. To answer your question, a project like our Shiloh project, the number of jobs, we're talking about over 150 probably over 200, between 150 and 200 construction jobs just to get the project going. That's not to mention there's a variety of economic positive impacts from any wind project. In terms of manufacturing, I actually used to work for GE Wind Energy in Tehachapi on the manufacturing side. I was on the commercial side selling the widgets. But the manufacturing of wind turbines has moved overseas, although I should say we have seen a number of manufacturers make announcements for blade, tower, other assembly plants, but not in California.
Okay. Thank you so much. Mark Thalke is director of the Southwest Region for renewable energy company Enexco. Joining us earlier to talk about the impact of wind farms and birds was ecologist Sean Smallwood. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, the local Olympic gold medalist, Gabe Gardner of U.S. Men's Volleyball. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can podcast Insight. Sign up at capradio.org/insight. The city of Sacramento is trying to get as much building done as possible in Natomas before a federal ban on construction in the flood-prone area takes effect. Tomorrow in Insight, you'll hear why. There's also a report on that topic from KXJZ News tomorrow morning at 6:35 and 8:35. Some local Olympians returned with medals. Last week, we spoke with Stephanie Trafton-Brown of Galt, who won gold in women's discus. Today, we'll talk with Gabe Gardner, who also came home with a gold in men's volleyball. He lives in Carmichael. Gabe Gardner, welcome to Insight.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You were good enough to bring in your gold medal, and I'm just looking at it and admiring it and noting how heavy it is.
Yeah, it's a lot heavier than most people think. And, you know, I brought it in because, you know, after you win a gold medal, you feel like showing it off a little bit. So I figure you'd appreciate that.
I do. Do you wear it much? Do you show up at parties and go, hey?
To be perfectly honest, I wore it probably for 48 hours after I won it, and I got more attention than I ever wanted or needed. So I stopped taking it. I took it off for a little while. But it's quite amazing if you have that thing around your neck, how many people will come up and just completely at awe over it.
What's it like the moment you put it on for the first time?
Well, it represents so much to me because I've, like most people in their lives, I've done this career. I've worked towards this goal for such a long time. Since I was 10 years old, I thought about going to the Olympics and I never envisioned a gold medal being around my neck. So it means a lot to me. And every time I put it on, it kind of all comes back grounded back to that point in time where I thought, hey, you know, I could do this, and here I am today, and I've done it.
My guest is the local Olympian, Gabe Gardner, a member of the gold medal-winning U.S. men's volleyball team. He lives in Carmichael. That was quite some final game against Brazil. It wasn't clear how it was going to go.
Well, Brazil's been the best team in the world for quite a while, and they've dominated literally for about six of the last 8 years, winning the last Olympic gold medal. So, but we got ahead of steam at the right time, and we were really, really playing well and with a lot of confidence and a group of guys, a team around us that has been together for a long time. So it was all the planets, all the stars were aligned for us to come away with a goal, and that happened. And we feel real lucky to do that.
When you watch a basketball game, so you don't realize how tall the players are because everyone on the court is tall. And it's the same with volleyball. When you walk into the studio, you're a tall guy. Gabe, how tall are you?
I'm 6'9". And I imagine that quite a few Sacramentians and people in the area have thought at one point in time that I do play basketball.
Why you have the physique and the athleticism to play basketball? Did you ever play basketball, or was volleyball always your sport?
Actually, I was a three-sport athlete in Southern California, and I also played water polo and basketball. You know, you're kind of a product. As an athlete, you're kind of a product of what's working at the time. And in my high school, when I was growing up, volleyball was very popular and had a good history, and our teams were successful. Basketball wasn't that way. I would have had to change schools or change areas to go to a more proficient basketball program. Same thing with water polo. I come from a really good water polo school. So a lot of my Olympian friends happen to be water polo players, actually. And I ran into a lot of them who won the silver medal last time. So,
do you think volleyball could ever take off and become a really big sport around the world?
Well, that's a tricky question. I guess the tricky part of it is here in the U.S. because in the world, in terms of the world, it is very popular. Most people, I've told some of your staff, actually, I've played professionally in the last 8 years in 8 different countries around the world in their own professional leagues. So it is popular overseas. It's just in America we don't know much about it.
Why is that?
That's the golden question, right? You know, just exposure. In my opinion, volleyball had a good run in 84 and 88 when we won the gold, and we kind of didn't really capitalize on it when we were a sport. and kind of make it and promote it and do the right things to start a professional league here in the U.S., and we kind of missed our window of opportunity. The rest of the world has been doing it for 8 to 10 years. You know, leagues like in Italy, for example, where I played last season, I played in Milan. I mean, it's on TV as much as any NBA or, you know, baseball match here is in the U.S. So,
you've played professionally in many countries. What an experience that must be.
Oh, it's a great experience. I wouldn't trade it for the world. And, you know, if anything, just opens my eyes to what there is outside the U.S. and the cultural differences, but beauties, I like to say.
What's your favorite country that you've played in?
I don't have one. I got to be totally honest. I love them all for different reasons. And I think people, those of you who have traveled enough out there with the listeners, I mean, you know that you can pick apart a country for things you don't like, but you can also relate to a lot of things that are cool about specific places, and that's kind of how I am.
My guest is the volleyball player, Gabe Gardner. He won a gold medal in the 2008 Olympics. How does working as a pro volleyball player around the world fit in with your life as a husband and father in this area?
Well, it's challenging at times, but I got the greatest wife in the world, and she's actually a doctor here in Sacramento, and we've moved here recently for that reason, and we have a good one-year-old son. And
How much of the year are you away?
She understands. I think she understands that there's a definite end to this career as an athlete, like there are for most, and she knows that at some point I'll be that, well, hopefully not too boring, but boring guy that's there every day and every weekend, and it's just, so she's been pretty supportive up to this point.
How long do you think you'll continue as a pro volleyball player?
You know, 4 years ago I said this could be my last year. You know, 2 years ago I said this could be my last year. It's tough to say because in our sport internationally, it's grown a lot, and the contracts for players like us are quite lucrative, especially after doing something like winning a gold medal. So financially and just for lifestyle, it's afforded me a good lifestyle the last couple of years with the way the sport's grown internationally. Over in Russia, for example, where I'm going next season to play.
How much of the year are you away?
About 6 to 7 months, starting end of September, going through beginning to end of April, depending on how my professional team will do in the playoffs if we get exited earlier, which actually I kind of hope sometimes, you know, I'm kind of like, I kind of want to get back home. So
you're going to be in Russia next season?
Yeah, I will be.
Well, things aren't so good between the U.S. and Russia nowadays. Does that concern you?
Not at all. Actually, believe it or not, you've probably heard, got caught wind of this, but things aren't so good between the U.S. and a lot of countries I've been in. You know, people don't view Americans in the same light that they used to overseas. So I catch a lot of slack, politically speaking, when I work in foreign countries. But in the end, it matters about who you are and who you are to them. And I've forged some great relationships with every different nationality.
The U.S. men's volleyball team had an unfortunate start to the Olympics. Your coach's in-laws were attacked. Hugh McCutcheon's father-in-law was killed, his mother-in-law seriously injured, and he obviously had to take a short leave of absence. How did that affect the team?
Well, it was tough at first, right away. Just so many of us had our families coming over to the Olympics. Of course, the first thought was, well, you know, were they attacked because they were Americans? That didn't turn out to be the case, fortunately. But a lot of us were worried about our families right away, naturally. Kind of after that time had passed, we just worried about our coach more and kind of how he would respond. And a lot of us knew his wife really well because she was a women's volleyball player. I've actually known his wife, Wiz, who was there witnessing a lot of this going on, this tragic event. You know, I've known her since I was 16 and 17 because she was a young volleyball player with myself and on some of the USA junior teams. So he kind of just really, your heart goes out to her and just all the things that our coach had to go through and such an important time in their lives when they were looking forward to being at the Olympics and living their own dreams as a coach, you know. So that was really tough.
I saw Hugh McCutcheon being interviewed by Bob Costas on TV, and he just seemed so stoic and focused, and it was hard to imagine how he could do that after this shocking event so far from home.
Yeah, I think it shows what a great leader he was. I mean, he didn't want to make it about what had happened and the tragedy. As much as, you know, some people want to make our success about that. I mean, we've been training 4 years and he's been coaching 4 years to live up to that goal of getting that gold medal. So he didn't want to take away from that. And I think that showed great leadership, because at the end of the day, we could have, you know, there definitely could have been some people who just went out and said, we did this for the coach. And we, you know, we played that string, that chord to the media's attention. But it really was about us and going out and doing what we'd trained a long time to do.
I've read that when you were at Stanford, you knew Sergey Brin, one of the founders of Google, who basically offered you a job and you turned it down because you're a volleyball player. Do you ever think, I could have been one of those early Google millionaires?
I stopped thinking about it. I stopped thinking about it because, I got a gold medal around my neck.
Yeah.
And all the money in the world can't replace that. And B, I just had this instinct 8 years ago that this is what I was meant to do for the next 8 or 10 years of my life, to really take advantage of this gift that, you know, God or my parents or whoever given me, to be a great athlete and to play for our country. I mean, USA on my back, it's different than playing for, you know, a small hometown team or just for my family. I mean, the USA was on my back the whole Olympics, and it really felt good to bring home a medal for our country as well.
Indeed. Well, congratulations again, Gabe, and thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for the Sacramento area, just in general, for supporting me through the Olympics. It's been an amazing welcoming from the Sacramento community.
That's Gabe Gardner, gold medal winner in the 2008 Olympics, a member of the U.S. men's volleyball team. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, singers Kate Gaffney and Sal Valentino. They're in our studio. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Email us suggestions for future topics on Insight. Our address is insight@capradio.org. Two of Sacramento's top singers are in concert together tonight. They're Kate Gaffney and Sal Valentino. Kate is a singer-songwriter of Americana rock, originally from Pennsylvania. Her new album, The Coachman, comes out in October. Sal Valentino is a pop and rock singer who got started back in the 60s with the Beau Brummels. His latest album, Every Now and Then, came out earlier this year. They play tonight at Harlow's. Right now, they're in our studio. Kate Gaffney, Sal Valentino, both of you, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kate, how did you and Sal get started playing concerts together?
When I returned from Philadelphia to Sacramento, Sal and I knew Sal. I don't know if Sal knew me, but I knew Sal a few years ago when I lived here before. And I guess we ran into each other at an open mic, or Marta DeAnda over Dig Music introduced us. It's all one big happy Dig family.
Yes.
So we started playing together and becoming friends and hanging out musically.
Well, Sal, Kate knew you. Did you know Kate?
I did. I saw her open. I think the first time I saw you when you opened for Jackie was at New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
At
Jackie
Maryland's.
Green.
Yeah, for Jackie Green, yeah. And so I knew of her. And then a friend of mine who comes to record me all the time, he was real fond of her. And so we went to see her at Maryland's the first time I saw her with a band. First time I saw her with Jackie, she was alone. And she was really good with the band. And that was quite a while ago. And then she had me come down one night, and we sang a song together. And since then, we've talked about doing duets together. I want to do a duet with her. I did two on my album. And she's the best singer I know of.
Well, we're going to hear that. She's going to play
okay.
In our studio in just a moment. But first, Kate, you've been working for a long time on this album, The Coachman, and it's not quite out yet.
But it's almost there. We even there's even a review of it in the Newsroom Review this week.
So yes. Yes, there was. Now, you're going to play something for us in our studio. What are you going to play?
I'm going to play What Kind of Man.
Excellent. Well, we'll look forward to it.
My sister, she once told me, don't be lonely. Find yourself a good man. Find yourself a hand to hold. And don't let go. So I found the one I wanted. Pretty boy, but his heart was haunted, like a wishing well to a rolling river through the gates of hell. What kind of man would drop a woman from the highest mountain top? What kind of man would live
like all blue sea. What kind of man would keep you crying in the middle of a night? My kind of man, my kind of man. My daddy told me when I was young, you can't go out all night and have your fun. If you choose the same life that I did, you won't lose, but you never win. What kind of man would drop a woman from the highest mountain top? What kind of man would leave you drowning in the cold blue sea? What kind of man would keep you crying in the middle of the night? My kind of man, my kind of man. My mama told me, stand up tall. Girl, you might be lonely, but you can have it all. And so I did the best that I could do. Never realizing was you. What kind of man would drop a woman from the highest mountain top? What kind of man would leave you drowning in the cold blue sea? What kind of man would keep you crying in the middle of the night? My kind of man, my kind of man, my kind of man.
Very nice. What Kind of Man, sung by Kate Gaffney with some backing vocals from Sal Valentino. What Kind of Man is on Kate's upcoming album, The Coachman. Sal, do you were you just casually joining in there, or do you sing along with Kate on stage as well?
No, I'd like to, though. Whenever I go to see her, I sing, but she doesn't need me. She has other people up there to sing. But I like that song a lot.
Yeah, we should work that one out for a live experience,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, we could. I'm ready.
Okay, tonight. No, maybe.
Kate, you mentioned the review of your album in the Sacramento News and Review. Jackson Griffith wrote it, and he really likes your album. In fact, he said he adored it. But he also said, quote, "It sounds like the work of someone whose record collection doesn't contain too many surprises." Do you want to surprise Jackson Griffith with something in your record collection?
Yeah, Morphine. I love Morphine.
I know Morphine.
They're great.
Yeah,
it was definitely not Americana, definitely not country or rock and roll. Well, they're rock and roll, but yeah.
I hope Jackson Griffith's listening.
Well, he might have Morphine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're great.
Kate, you were recently in New Orleans for the Warner Brothers convention.
It was a Ryko distribution. Ryko Disc is distributing my album through Dig Music, which is the label that I'm on here in Sacramento. And I did a showcase down there for all the people who work for Ryko and all the labels that they work with, and it was
to do what? What's the point of that for an artist like you?
I was there representing my label, Dig Music. So it was just a networking opportunity for both the label and for me, and to meet all the people who are gonna be hopefully pushing my album come October.
Also on Dig Music is Sal Valentino's album Every Now and Then, which came out earlier this year. And we've got a clip from that lined up. This is the title track, Every Now and Then.
I've been so many places. I've been around. I've been around. Seeing so many smiling faces turn into frowns, turn into frowns.
Sal, tell us about the song.
Jackie Greene wrote it for me. He wrote it for me just after I met him. I don't know if I've told this before. Well, I guess we didn't talk about this before. Jackie had Marty DeAnda who is Dig Records and Dig Music, suggested I mentor Jackie. And I said, okay. I didn't really know what I was supposed to do. And so I met him, and he called me and told me he wrote a song for me. And so I went to hear it one night. We were both so nervous we didn't know what to say, but I really liked it. And we were going to do an album together. He wanted to produce a record for me, and we never got around to that because of our schedules. And then finally we got it done here. He also wrote a song with Kate on her record, which is good too. Jackie's a nice writer, but it was his first song written for me in a long time.
Did he play any of the instruments on it?
Yes, he's playing on this, yeah. Yeah. We recorded it probably about 4 or 5 times.
Is he easy to work with?
Yeah, he's pretty easy to work with. Although neither of us talk much when we're together, so it's hard to say. I don't know, if you were there, you would wonder what they're thinking or something like that. But he doesn't ask. He gets in there and he knows. And Jackie comes prepared. He's real good that way.
Yep.
Yeah.
Kate, what was your experience like?
Oh, he's great. He came in the studio with me, and he's just a great studio guy, especially. Everyone, the producers, engineers are thrilled with him because his timing is impeccable. He just can do whatever you ask him to do.
Your album, The Coachman, has musicians from both the Americana and the jam band scenes. I think of your music as being more Americana. Are you into the jam band stuff as well?
I do. I like it. I like the scene. There's a lot of community around it, a lot of support. I think Americana and the jam band communities kind of come together with the new grass revival. There's a lot of bluegrass type stuff, a little country, and kind of all fits together. And it's really about music that people are just open to music in that community, I think, and it seems a crossover.
So your album comes out quite soon, just over a month's time. Then what, are you going to be touring at all?
Hopefully. We're going to be pushing as much as possible and playing as much as we can, and we're going to do some radio promotion and publicity and see what happens. We got to put it out there and see if you all like it.
Sounds good, but I've heard.
Thanks.
It plays well, her record. It's good. She's a good singer. Good sounding singer, too. She picks good songs.
You and Sal are in concert tonight at Harlow's. Are you going to be playing tracks from the album, The Coachman?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And what about you, Sal? You're going to be doing songs from Every Now and Then?
Yes.
All right. You're going to have a string section?
Yes.
That's a pretty big deal, isn't it?
It is to me.
That's Sal Valentino and Kate Gaffney. They're both in concert tonight at Harlow's in Midtown Sacramento. Sal's album Every Now and Then came out this year. Kate's Gaffney comes out early October. It's called The Coachman. Kate Gaffney, Sal Valentino, thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more information about the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Today's associate producers were Ellie Fox and Donna Lee. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The assistant producer, Robin Souza. The senior producer is Jen Picard. And thank you for joining us. Sacramento's trying to get as much building done as possible in Natomas before a federal ban on construction in the flood-prone area takes effect. On the next Insight, you'll hear why. Also, singer-songwriter Chris Webster tells you about not being able to sing. She's been undergoing treatment for a throat condition. And Sacramento country rock band Trainwreck Revival performs in our studio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
That's tomorrow at 2 on KXJZ.